Hello and welcome to Talking Tourism, the podcast series especially for tourism operators and industry professionals. I'm Luke Martin, I'll be your host for today's episode. Talking Tourism is an initiative of Tourism Industry Council Tasmania. TICT is the peak industry body for the tourism industry in the beautiful state of Tasmania. If you are a regular listener to Talking Tourism, welcome back. If you're a first-time listener and enjoy today's conversation, remember there are now more than 100 episodes of Talking Tourism available from wherever you access your podcasts, or you can simply stream them off the TICT website at tict.com.au. We are recording this podcast today on the lands of the Palawa and the Pakana, and TICT offers its respect to the Tasmanian Aboriginal people, their elders past and present, for their enduring care and management of these islands. Today's episode is also actually brought to us by the custodians of Tasmania's protected areas now, the Tasmanian Parks and Wildlife Service. PWS presents, protects and manages our Tasmania's extraordinary landscape in partnership with the community. They work to conserve the state's natural and cultural heritage while providing for sustainable use and economic opportunities for the Tasmanian community. Thanks to the PWS for their generous support at TICT and for helping to make this episode of Talking Tourism possible. But now let's get into today's conversation, and I am joined by Kim Goods, the Managing Director at 3P Advisory. Kim will be well known to many Tasmanians as one of the foremost public voices in the state. She has over two decades' experience of working in government and for the not-for-profit sector in social and economic public policy fields as diverse as education, employment, transport, energy, digital inclusion, health, housing and human services. Kim has worked across both public and private sectors and is a sought-after advisor specialising in public engagement and evidence-informed public policy and program responses. She was also, for some period, the chair of the East Coast Regional Tourism Organisation, so she certainly knows a thing or two about tourism. G'day, Kim.
G'day, Luke.
Thank you for joining us.
That's okay.
You were a chair of the East Coast RTO for a couple of years there. Mm. What was your take out of that experience?
I went into the role just as COVID was hitting, and you and I think, were in a workshop together, Luke, in Bishanoe when we got news that Federal Hotels had decided shut their doors.
What a day.
And I think I'd been in the role about 4 weeks at that point. And my first taste of that area and working more intensively with the tourism industry than I had previously was in quite a period of absolute disruption globally and domestically. And what I saw at that point was an industry that was more like a family than an industry. At a local level on the East Coast, certainly everybody had each other's backs and worked pretty hard to do whatever was necessary to keep as many small businesses particularly afloat as possible. And so my first experience was actually of an industry that really cared about each other. Mm. They were more interested in collaboration than competition. Obviously, as the management of that pandemic early months started to settle, I saw an industry that really is vital to small towns and communities across Tasmania, as well as our bigger cities. So for me, it was really, I think, just getting a different insight to an industry I'd seen from the other side, not being actually deeply immersed within. And it's pretty spectacular, you know, like all industries, it's not always perfect, but equally its contribution to social and economic life in Tasmania is unquestionable.
So that's an interesting point. You've spent, you know, 20, 25 years in Tasmania observing tourism, mm-hmm. seeing its impact, probably commenting on it. Your perception after being in it for a couple of years at that level enhanced your respect for how tourism operates, or?
Yeah, I typify that kind of Tasmanian. I was born and bred here in Launceston, where we are today. I grew up on the Tama River, and so I've seen what I would call the good and the disruption of tourism in our state, and I've seen where potentially policy levers and policy settings by government and industry with hindsight could be adjusted and reset. But equally, most tourism businesses in Tasmania, like most businesses in Tasmania, are small. They're small micro businesses. At best, they might employ 4 people, you know, maybe even at a mid-size up to 10 or 15. But a lot of them are just family operators. So I think that often people see the big end of town in industry, yeah. and they forget that sitting around that sort of highlighted big end of town is actually the average Tasmanian mum, dad and family making a living in their communities, and they love their communities just as much as the rest of us Tasmanians do.
Yeah, and that's a good segue into what a reason we've got you joining today. So we're recording this at the Tourism Conference in 2022, which is called Positive Impact, and it's very much about I guess, turning our attention beyond COVID to the next sort of iteration of Tasmania's tourism evolution. And I guess this challenge around how do we as an industry apply a positive impact on the Tasmanian, leave Tasmania better because of tourism. And this is a really interesting challenge. And I know it's something that you carry close, particularly around the social element. So when you think of that phrase, positive impact on the Tasmanian community from a social impact, what goes to your mind? What are the measures of that?
So there's a couple of things. Even when I first saw that was the theme for this year's conference, it demonstrates to me just how far the thinking of this industry has moved, because it's looking out, it's thinking about its external impact as well as its internal on its own ability to make a profit and earn a living and be part of the economy of Tasmania. But the other thing, I guess, that I think about is that in a world that is sort of trying to cope with living with COVID now, I'm not ever talking about a post-COVID world at the moment, because I think that our reality is that we will live with this virus for a long time. How do we make sure that we don't forget to look around us in our communities and make sure that we leave a good footprint behind as corporate citizens? I'm a small business, just like tourism operators are small businesses. And we can get this, what I call the sweet spot between social and economic development right, but we have to have a line of sight to it and a really clear focus on it. It won't happen accidentally. We won't accidentally leave a good footprint behind. It needs to be intentional. So my view is that this industry is at a maturity level and at a level where the last couple of years has helped to potentially rally people together to think about more than just their day-to-day turning over of trade and profit, and also thinking who around me will matter as I run my business.
So let's unpack that, I guess, from a macro and a micro level. And I know you advise a lot of businesses on this very topic at the moment, but let's have a macro. The impact is, say, the good and the bad of tourism in every destination, every place on the planet. And Tasmanians, we know, when we poll them, they overwhelmingly value the role that tourism plays around the economic opportunities, I guess the vibrancy of the community, they get that. But we've talked a lot about housing, for example, and particularly on the East Coast, about the impact of short stay. How do we tackle those as a macro issue in a place like Tasmania? What's the balance right about vibrancy and economic activity and, you know, again, not undermining the market for average Tasmanians to continue to live, you know, healthy, safe lives in these regional communities?
The first thing I'd say is that we have to learn from hindsight. So I don't think any of us sitting here in 2022 could have predicted the level of growth, not just in tourism, but in the Tasmanian positioning on the world stage, be that in our products and a range of, you know, whether that's wine or fresh produce or our the incredible growth of the whiskey and spirits industry, for example, through to mountain biking, etc. I think we all knew that we had the potential for it, but that the speed that would happen was not as we would have known. So I think we should at this point almost pause and think, well, with hindsight, what might we now have done differently now that we know what the impact has been? And so there are, across local, state and federal governments, across those three tiers of government, what policy levers were available that with hindsight we could now think about setting up for the next decade in order to be able to say, right, we've learnt from that. How are we going to set these communities up to get this balance right between visitor numbers and the need to house staff in seasonal areas like tourism versus ensuring the local way of life and local people are also first and foremost preferenced in that environment? And when you look to other parts of the country and internationally, there are some good models we could also be learning from, thinking about key worker accommodation around the fringes of regional towns, for example, so that we can make sure that those seasonal workforces who are coming in and out of communities are able to live good lives themselves and enjoy those communities, but equally not displace local people, just as one example. But there's definitely legislative reform agendas and terms of policies around short stay that I think are now absolutely primed to be tackled in this next few years.
It's interesting, the enlightened thinking and more, I guess, holistic way we're looking at these issues now. Than I remember the short stay accommodation was very much about, you know, not doing something to make housing more unaffordable for people who are struggling to find a roof over their head, to now be a simple core risk for my business is the inability for me to employ staff.
That's right.
Because they can't get a house in our
anywhere.
Regional community. And so, you know, again, it's this way we've evolved this thinking now that's actually we're invested in this issue and right. the sustainability of our own industry as well as obviously the components. So,
and look, I think the, you know, the key word in that is what's mutual and how do we get this mutual and shared approach to making sure that the Tasmanian way of life as best we can is preserved, local people can live good lives in their local communities where they've always grown up and lived, but that an industry can thrive alongside of that because mutually that's beneficial for all of us, not just parts of it.
What about the other great perennial social challenge of Tasmania, which is this I guess participation levels in our workforce and this, you know, multi-generational disadvantage.
Yeah.
I mean, where do you see tourism play a greater role in that?
If you want to leave a good social footprint behind as a business in Tasmania right now and you're operating in, I'll use Tryabunna as a great example, where less than 10% of the current population of Tryabunna, according to the latest ABS data, have completed year 12 or greater. So less than 10%. So about 90% of people living in that part of Tasmania have no qualifications beyond year 12. So as a tourism industry or any other industry, part of that social dividend that we can start to think differently about is if I'm going to employ in that region, how do I contribute to ensuring I have really good professional development within my business? How do I support people I employ, not just to earn a good living every day, but also to potentially start to increase their vocational qualifications, all the way through to the work that we will hear about with Hamlet, where what if we were open to different employment models? And so really great examples in the US around open employment where really good employers are saying, I'm not going to go through the usual process of asking for long CVs and references and long interviews that really don't bring out the best in people. I'm going to say in a period in Australia and Tasmania where we've got major labour shortages, not just skill shortages, if you are highly motivated and you want a job, come and work for me. And once you get here, I'll help to work together to give you what you need to be good for my business, but equally I'll work with you to be able to continue to develop up your vocational skills. So this partnership approach is a really different way of thinking where we're all in this together. The skill shortage and the labour shortage is impacting every part of Australia at the moment. Could this industry be groundbreaking in saying, actually, we will go to communities where we know people have struggled for employment and we'll work with them to help them be job ready, not the other way around?
So that's the perfect segue into the micro, because this is the challenge. If I'm a B&B operator or I'm a tour operator in Tryabunna or St. Helens and I'm thinking, well, what can I do? What are the partnerships I can do? What's the, you know, don't wait for TRCT or the Tasmanian government or someone to tell you this is the pathway. You can start fostering these relationships now. And I'm interested in Hamlet because I've obviously doing that now with a couple of the major employers. So those practical examples, what does that look like on the ground? If I've got a school down the road, for example, if I've got a training provider, reaching out, picking up the phone, how do you do it?
So there are really practical ways, firstly, to get to know who's around you in your community so that you can then think, you know, what's the mutual here? Most businesses quite rightfully start from the point of what do I need as a business next? But when you have that first thought and, you know, let's use I need more staff and I don't have them as a practical example, then thinking about, well, what do the people in this community who don't have a job also need? And finding your mutual common piece of that is really your starting point. In smaller regional parts of Tasmania, most people know each other. So St. Helens is a great example where someone like Steve Wally runs the local jobs hub. And so any local tourism operator in most small regional parts of Tasmania can reach out to their skill centre, their jobs hub, or through a range of the Business TAS models that are all free, and they can say, hey, I want to find out who is motivated to work in this community because I'm going to look at a different way of engaging. I'm not going to go through that usual process.
And how do you measure success as a business? How do you, you know, you say again, small micro businesses, very limited cash flow, struggling on skills issues. So what's the dividend that you're looking for as a business?
Yeah, so the question I say to businesses, which sort of, I mean, to put it bluntly, it's a bit wanky, but, you know, what is your why? Beyond earning an income or making a profit, why do you exist as a business in this community? What's your corporate citizenship in this community as a small, medium or large business? And then I say to businesses, what is the footprint and the legacy you want to leave because you existed in this community, which is beyond just your turning over of your business operations? And so the way that I work with businesses to help them understand what their impact is, which is quite broad, we look at five key areas. Firstly, your contribution through your workforce, if you have one. So can you be supporting people who are perhaps generally not seen as people you might employ? How might you bring people into your business to, you know, who are really motivated to work but may not have had the right background that you would traditionally have looked for, and how do you build them up in your business to be the best they can be? The second thing that we would measure would be, what's your broader community contribution? Are you looking at local charities? Are you working more closely with, you know, supporting local groups to be able to have a meeting room? There's a lot of ways you can really, at a grassroots, no cost level, contribute socially in your community. The third thing that is probably talked about a bit more than it used to be, but is actually a lot more broader than people realise, is what's your environmental footprint? And so obviously that's part of that discussion around carbon offset, etc. But it's actually a lot more than that. It's about waste. It's about a whole range of things that, you know, in terms of circular economy, how are you thinking about those things at the very beginning of what you're setting up and running, so that everything you're doing is leaving the minimal environmental footprint possible? And then there's pure social impact. So that is, do you want to become part of, you know, a lot of businesses that I'm going to show this afternoon in the presentation, for example, you know, donating a percentage of every year's profits back into a social cause within their community. In my business, I'm, you know, not ashamed to say I run a business to make a profit, but I discount by 5% all work that I do for not-for-profits. I've allocated a proportion of my time each year for pro bono work, and I volunteer for each paid board that I sit on. I offset that board with an unpaid volunteer board. So there are a lot of ways that you can manage your community footprint and your social footprint. And the fifth one is, how transparent and open are you with the community around you about all of those things and how you run your business without your commercial in confidence information being publicly available? But how do you report back to your community about how you run your business and what's important to you? So the other work that I do is to help businesses develop up an annual impact report that is publicly available on websites, so that they can set themselves goals, measure their own improvement, but tell their community about it as well.
And that's not something that's just for a big operator. I mean, in fact, it's very practical and simple for all those steps.
You know, that's
again,
right.
Every business, there would be not a single tourism business in the state who wouldn't donate the occasional free night or tour operators to the local school. That don't do something in the environment that they're doing. A lot of businesses are doing this stuff or wanting to gear up.
Yeah.
And again, it's, don't be shy about scale of what you're doing it. Brag, be positive about it, because, you know, there's a whole bunch of other businesses that aren't telling what they do.
Look at your supply chain, for example, and think about in the B Corp work I do, the goal is 80. If you can get a score of 80, you can go through a B Corp process. And in developing up assessments for that, how can I look within 80 kilometres of where I live and see how much I could use that supply chain as a preferencing over any other supply chain, as an example? And even in a little business like mine, that's what I do. I on purposely drive a little bit further to a locally run service station to put petrol in my car. I haven't got an electric vehicle. I wish I did. But if I'm going to buy petrol, I will on purposely look for a locally run petrol station. So it doesn't matter what type of business you
support run, the IGA in the local region. Not the worst in
that
bigger
exactly
town.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So think about, you know, marginalised groups and how you can preference. And again, I'll show some examples this afternoon of Intrepid on the global stage, who are using women in Nepal as Sherpas, where women are traditionally made to stay at home. They've pushed beyond that and they've been able to establish really high profile and highly regarded roles for women in their community. There are many examples that we can do locally.
So B Corp, explain to me, that's something you're you're doing? That's so it's an international process to go through.
That's right. So B Corp's an international foundation and a movement which really helps from micro businesses all the way through to major like T2 or really big corporates. It is a way of thinking not just about shareholder value anymore but stakeholder value. So, yes, we want to see businesses definitely make a profit and be able to, you know, do that. It's not trying to take away from that commercial imperative, but it's saying who are the shareholders around me who I need to think about as I run my business every day. And so I've become Tasmania's first B Corp consultant. So I've gone through their training and I'm now able to go and work with businesses who either want to go through the B Corp certification process, which is quite a stringent process, or who just want some guidance on how to be a good corporate citizen and think about those five areas that I was describing earlier so that they can get a sense of where am I at right now and how can I set some goals so that I'm on a journey towards that improvement. And it is a constant improvement process.
So just to say it's a business planning mechanism that you're slightly broadening out your stuff you're doing anyway and
that's
recognising
right.
what you're doing and formalising it into your business practices.
Exactly. And a lot of the work that 3P and my work has been about bringing community and stakeholder voice to the front when decisions are being made either by government or by development. So this is really an extension of that as well to help a whole range of businesses in Tasmania just be able to get a better sense of what's around them in a community and some really simple actions they can take to be a better corporate citizen.
So at a macro level, when you say the positive impact, you say it's an enlightened thinking. We talked about what that might look like on the ground. How do we, as an industry, if we're sitting here in 2027, 2028 or 2030 and thinking on particularly on the social assessment of the industry's contribution, how would we measure success as an industry around making a positive impact in the Tasmanian community?
I think there's a couple of things that at an industry scale that you can be thinking about. One is by taking those five areas, you could ask yourselves as an industry and set some baselines now. How transparent and open are we when we are engaging, particularly, as you know, in that contested space around new development, new tourism development? And, you know, there is a rub for some around that. So thinking about your transparency and how you are specifically involving communities in decisions that are being made in their local areas. What do you do now and how as an industry could you set a standard of best practice? Because there are best practice ways of doing that would be a starting point. You could measure the diversity now of your workforce. What's the ways in the B Corp model, for example, you would say, what does it look like between the lowest paid and the highest paid across our industry right now? And how might we try and get a better balance on that? What is our commitment to professionally develop people who walk in at entry level with very few qualifications? What's our responsibility as an industry to help to better skill up and give better qualifications to Tasmanians who commit to be working in our industry and choose a career in our industry? What's the two-way mutual relationship and what part of that as an industry can we make sure we nurture? And, you know, the establishment of your RTO and the work you're doing in that space is really an important step in that direction. You can be thinking about a range of ways that you're contributing to supporting local through supply chain, for example, and thinking about how, as an industry, you could measure that and what's it like now and set some goals to where you might want to be. And that is, it's challenging in some parts and you can park some bits and say, well, insurance, for example, we might use local brokers, but ultimately Lloyd's of London are going to be the underwriter of all of our insurance. But what can we control?
But you still can at a local level. Like we've looked at the carbon challenge in detail and clearly the sector 3 emissions is the big play because it's, you know, it's sector wide. So
that's right.
You do the same thing on a social
you can
balance,
do exactly
say that
the same
the example
thing.
Of the local school, that should be tackled on an individual operator view. It should be done with a group of operators collaborating. And I mean, it shocks me a few times I have done things with Beacon, for example, and you ask a question about who's done the local major attraction on the west coast or the east coast, who's done the tour, who's done it, and none of the kids put their hands up. And it's like, well, surely that's not a big step for us to just start to introduce those sorts of local
and
collaboration.
And we're sitting here in Launceston today, not far from us in the suburb of Ravenswood. The last time I had a look at data there, which was probably 5 years ago, something like 80% of the children at that primary school had never been to a beach. So there are opportunities for an industry to be able to give little people who don't have the opportunities that our children have, even to be able to get a bus tour and go to a beach and have a day at a beach is a really simple contribution a tourism industry might make to kids or, you know, children potentially in Smithton who haven't been to a city and haven't experienced a zoo or... You know, there are ways that as an industry you could think about what my local contribution is going to be to expand the horizons and the opportunities for everybody around me in my community. They're very simple ways and it's easy to forget that not everybody lives the lives that we live.
Yeah, and there'd be a couple of coach tour operators that'd be listening to that right now, that point,
based in Launceston. Might be why I threw that in.
Yeah, and I'm sure we can make their inquiries. We'll put the show notes of who to contact at Ravenswood Primary if you can do it.
The final message I think on this is it isn't hard or complicated to be a good corporate citizen in Tasmania. It just takes intent and purpose. It won't happen accidentally. You do need to put some time and thinking into it. And at a micro level all the way through to an industry level, you could set some targets and definitely put together an improvement plan so that you can start to track what you're going to do over the next 5 years to move to that point as an industry.
Great insights. Thank you, Kim. It's exactly what I was hoping you'd be able to offer. And you mentioned you're doing a workshop here at the conference, and I think there's more of this space we need to do, a bit like the carbon conversation.
That's
around the industry.
Right.
Everyone's motivated to want to learn more. They want to know. They just need to be reaffirmed about the pathway in which you do it. And as I say, what you reaffirmed is it's not something that's beyond the scope of any business operating, any organisations. Just
once you understand it, it's actually quite logical, but people resist to because it feels like a space I don't know about, but it's actually a really open space to work in.
All right. Well, thank you. And now, before we let you go, the seven big questions.
Oh, I didn't know about the seven big questions.
You don't know about the seven, but you didn't read your pre-brief, Kim.
Didn't.
Oh, these are going to be straight off the bat.
I was going to say, so you will get spontaneous Kim now, that's for sure.
And I tell you what, you'll get texts about these answers, Kim.
Oh, no.
And you carry roles across the states. I think about the geographical split on your answers to some of these questions, including your favourite spot in Tasmania and why.
Oh, my absolute favourite spot in Tasmania is Kelso on the Tama River because my mum and dad, Kana Maluka, she's the Tama, my mum and dad had a shack there growing up and it's where my most special childhood memories are.
So whereabouts is that? How far is that?
It's right near Greens Beach. It's right at the tip of the Tama, of Kana Maluka.
It's pretty amazing, the Tama Valley. It's just everyone wants to take for granted.
Yeah.
Favourite place I've been to in the world and why?
I think Florence. I had a really incredible experience in Florence, although as I'm saying that, the other most beautiful place was I did a multi-day Mont Blanc.
Wow.
So I did the seven-day walk around the top of Mont Blanc.
Wow.
So both those kind of in my mind.
Bucket list.
Incredible, but the Mont Blanc trail was stunning. My favourite city in the world is Florence. It's a romantic, stunning, sophisticated, beautiful city.
Sounds fantastic. All right. Someone coming to Tasmania for the very first time in their lives, what's the one thing you tell them they must do?
I think probably Wine Glass Bay.
Yeah.
Again, I love it there as well, but external people, I think it takes your breath away.
Always say the thing about Wine Glass Bay, how many places you go to where the postcard image
is
compromised?
On.
Yeah, with Wine Glass Bay, it exceeds it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's just, there is no implementation, there's no buildings over to the side that you get cut out of the photo. It is better than what you...
I agree.
You're walking the Overland track. You've done the Overland?
I haven't. I've done sections of it, but I haven't done it as a whole.
Well, when you do the Overland track for 5 days, three people, living or dead, famous or not famous, who are they and why?
Three people. Well, Paul Keating would be...
Paul Keating.
Yeah, absolutely. He would keep me intellectually stimulated for the whole thing. I'd have to say my incredibly amazing bushwalking husband, Gary Bailey, because he is first and foremost a mountain man, which most people who know him well know, and I will never, ever get lost when Gary and I are together, and my sense of direction is horrendous, so that would be an absolute. But I do tell Gary that the two men that I would leave him for, one is Paul Keating and the other is George Clooney. So I think I'd take George Clooney along with me just for a bit of visual entertainment as opposed to the Paul Keating.
That would be a mentally exhausting, as would be physically exhausting Paul had a bit back in the day too. You'd given George a bit of a go.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, you do a lot of travelling around the state. What's on the playlist?
Podcast-wise, I'm listening to some podcasts at the moment around social impact, but I actually, yesterday before I drove north, downloaded Josh Pike's new album.
Good.
Which is really good. Yeah, I listened to that on the way up after buying tickets for his November tour around Tassie. Yeah. So he's in Tassie. So, yeah, Josh Pike's new album.
Josh Pike. When you arrive at your destination, your first tipple of choice?
At the moment, I'm trying that to be mineral water.
I know. Tasmanian mineral water?
Tasmanian mineral water, you bet. Sad but true. But no, I'm a Springvale Chardonnay woman. I love my Chardies and I love Tasmanian wine. So, yeah, if I am going to have a wine, it'll be a Springvale Chardonnay.
And the last big question, the most divisive question in Tasmania right now, curried Tasmanian scallops, culinary delight or culinary crime?
Oh, well, again, I grew up on them. My mum used to cook a mean curried scallop. So I've got a nostalgic attachment to them, but I must admit my 21st century Kim would say don't ever put them in curry.
It's a funny one, isn't it? There's a romance about it, but when you strip it away,
the flavour of them is just, it's like oysters. I only eat my oysters natural.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those ones, I think. I think everyone caught up in the romance of Tasmanian authenticity, but when you actually pull it away, it's extraordinary Tasmanian seafood doused in curry powder.
Yep.
Kim Goods from 3P Consulting. Now, you have your own podcast too. You can give it a quick plug.
I will. I'll actually firstly say Kim Goods from 3P Advisory.
Advisory. So, yes, that's right. Get that right.
And my podcast is Frank and Fearless and it's about Tasmanian women. I've recorded 3 episodes to date and I'm about to relaunch with at least another 3. So hold this breath until probably early October and we'll have a few more episodes back out.
And without giving names away, they're big names. So
I was going to say they're quite exciting interviews coming and my website is www.3padvisory.com.au if you want to have a look at what we do and contact through the website.
There you go. All right. Thank you, Kim Goods. Thank you, everyone, for listening to today's episode of Talking Tourism. Remember to subscribe to hear more episodes as we release them every 2 weeks or so. Also, remember to tell a friend or tourism colleague to check out our podcasts. Talking Tourism is an initiative of Tourism Industry Council of Tasmania. Today's episode was brought to us with the assistance of the Tasmanian Parks and Wildlife Service. A big thanks also to Caleb Miller at Mac40 Media, our audio specialist who produces all these episodes. I'm your host, Luke Martin, and we'll catch you next time.